Archie Jones could give no longer record of his family than his father's own haphazard appearance on the planet in the back room of a Bromley public house circa 1895 or 1896 or quite possibly 1897, depending on which nonagenarian ex-barmaid you spoke to. Clara Bowden knew a little about her grandmother and half believed the story that her famed and prolific Uncle P had 34 children, but could only state definitively that her own mother was born at 2:45 p.m. the 14th of January 1907 in a Catholic church in the middle of the Kingston earthquake. The rest was rumour, folktale, and myth.
"You guys go so far back,"
said Irie as Marcus came up behind her to see what was of interest.
"It's incredible. I can't imagine what that must feel like."
"Nonsensical statement. We all go back as far as each other. It's just that the Chalfins have always written things down," said Marcus thoughtfully, stuffing his pipe with fresh tobacco. "It helps if you want to be remembered."
"I guess my family's more of an oral tradition," said Irie with a shrug. "But, man, you should ask Millat about his. He's a descendant of
a great revolutionary.
So I've heard."
"I wouldn't take any of that seriously if I were you. One part truth to three parts fiction in that family, I fancy."
"Any historical figure of note in your lot?"
asked Marcus, and then, immediately uninterested in his own question, returned to his search of filing cabinet number 2.
No one significant, but my grandmother was born in January 1907 during the Kingston..."
"Here we are!"
Marcus emerged triumphant from a steel drawer, brandishing a thin plastic folder with a few pieces of paper in it.
"Photographs, especially for you. If the animal rights lot saw these, I'd have a contract out on my life. One by one now, don't grab."
Marcus passed Irie the first photo. It was of a mouse on its back. Its stomach was littered with little mushroom-like growths, brown and puffy. Its mouth was unnaturally extended, by the prostrate position, into a cry of agony. But not genuine agony, Irie thought, more like theatrical agony, more like a mouse who was making a big show of something, a ham mouse, a lovey mouse. There was something sarcastic about it.
"You see, embryo cells are all very well. They help us understand the genetic elements that may contribute to cancer. But what you really want to know is how a tumour progresses in living tissue. I mean, you can't approximate that in a culture. Not really. So then you move on to introducing chemical carcinogens in a target organ, but..."
Irie was half listening, half engrossed in the pictures passed to her. The next one was of the same mouse, as far as she could tell, this time on its front, where the tumours were bigger. There was one in its neck that appeared practically the same size as its ear, but the mouse looked quite pleased about it, almost as if it had purposefully grown new apparatus to hear what Marcus was saying about him. Irie was aware this was a stupid thing to think about a lab mouse. But, once again, the mouse face had a mouse cunning about it. There was a mouse sarcasm in its mouse eyes. A mouse smirk played about its mouse lips. "Terminal disease," the mouse said to Irie.
"What terminal disease?" "Slow and imprecise. But if you re-engineer the actual genome, so that specific cancers are expressed in specific tissues at predetermined times in the mouse's development, then you're no longer dealing with the random. You're eliminating the random actions of a mutagen. Now you're talking the genetic program of the mouse, a force activating oncogenes within cells. Now you see, this particular mouse is a young male.
Now, a future mouse, copyright, was being held by his front paws by 2 pink giant fingers and made to stand vertical like a cartoon mouse, thus forcing his head up. He seemed to be sticking out his little pink mouse tongue at the cameraman initially, and now at Irie. On his chin, the tumours hung like big droplets of dirty rain.
"And he expresses the HRAS oncogene in certain of his skin cells, so he develops multiple benign skin papillomas. Now, what's interesting, of course, is young females don't develop it, which is..."
One eye was closed, the other open, like a wink, a crafty mouse wink.
"And why? Because of intermale rivalry. The fights lead to abrasion. Not a biological imperative, but a social one. Genetic result?
The same. You see?
And it's only with transgenic mice, by adding experimentally to the genome, that you can understand those kind of differences. And this mouse, the one you're looking at, is a unique mouse, Irie. I plant a cancer, and a cancer turns up precisely when I expect it. 15 weeks into the development, its genetic code is new. New breed. No better argument for a patent, if you ask me. Or at least some kind of royalties deal. 80% God, 20% me. Or the other way round, depending on how good my lawyer is. Those poor bastards in Harvard are still fighting the point. I'm not interested in the patent, personally. I'm interested in the science.
Wow, said Irie, passing back the pictures reluctantly. It's pretty hard to take in. I half get it, and I half don't get it at all. It's just amazing.
Well, said Marcus, mock humble. It fills the time.
Being able to eliminate the random.
You eliminate the random, you rule the world, said Marcus simply. Why stick to oncogenes? One could program every step in the development of an organism, reproduction, food habits, life expectancy. Automaton voice, arms out like a zombie, rolling eyeballs, world domination.
I can see the tabloid headlines, said Irie.
Seriously, though, said Marcus, rearranging his photos in the folder and moving towards the cabinet to refile them. The study of isolated breeds of transgenic animals sheds crucial light on the random. Are you following me? One mouse sacrificed for 5.3 billion humans. Hardly mouse apocalypse. Not too much to ask.
No, of course not.
Damn! This thing is such a bloody mess!
Marcus tried 3 times to shut the bottom drawer of his cabinet, and then, losing patience, levelled a kick at its steel sides.
Bloody thing!
Irie peered over the open drawer.
You need more dividers, she said decidedly, and a lot of the paper you're using is A3, A2, or irregular. You need some kind of folding policy. At the moment, you're just shoving them in.
Marcus threw his head back and laughed.
Folding policy? Well, I suppose you should know, like father, like daughter.
He crouched down by the drawer and gave it a few more pushes.
I'm serious. I don't know how you work like that. My school shit is better organised, and I'm not in the business of world domination.
Marcus looked up at her from where he was kneeling. She was like a mountain range from that angle, a soft and pillowy version of the Andes.
Look, how about this? I'll pay you 15 quid a week if you come round twice a week and get a grip on this filing disaster. You'll learn more, and I'll get something I need done. Hey? What about it?
What about it? Joyce already paid Milat a total of 35 quid a week for such diverse activities as babysitting Oscar, washing the car, weeding, doing the windows, and recycling all the coloured paper. What she was really paying for, of course, was the presence of Milat, that energy around her, and that reliance. Irie knew the deal she was about to make. She didn't run into it drunk or stoned or desperate or confused, as Milat did. Furthermore, she wanted it. She wanted to merge with the Chalfins, to be of one flesh, separated from the chaotic, random flesh of her own family and transgenically fused with another, a unique animal, a new breed. Marcus frowned.
Why all the deliberation? I'd like an answer this millennium, if you don't mind. Is it a good idea, or isn't it?
Irie nodded and smiled.
Sure is. When do I start?
Alsana and Clara were none too pleased, but it took them a little while to compare notes and consolidate their displeasure. Clara was in night school 3 days a week, courses British Imperialism 1765 to the present, medieval Welsh literature, black feminism. Alsana was on the sewing machine all the daylight hours God gave, while a family war raged around her. They talked on the phone only occasionally, and saw each other even less, but both felt an independent uneasiness about the Chalfins, of whom they had gradually heard more and more. After a few months of covert surveillance, Alsana was now certain that it was to the Chalfins Milat went during his regular absences from the family home.
As for Clara, she was lucky to get Irie in on a weeknight and had long ago rumbled her netball excuses. For months now, it had been the Chalfins this and the Chalfins that. Joyce said this wonderful thing. Marcus is so terribly clever. But Clara wasn't one to kick up a fuss. She wanted desperately what was best for Irie, and she had always been convinced that sacrifice was 9/10 of parenting. She even suggested a meeting between herself and the Chalfins, but either Clara was paranoid or Irie was doing her best to avoid it. And there was no point looking to Archibald for support. He only saw Irie in flashes when she came home to shower, dress, or eat, and it didn't seem to bother him whether she raved endlessly about the Chalfin children. They sound nice, love. Or about something Joyce did. Did she? That's very clever, isn't it, love? Or something Marcus had said. Sounds like a right old Einstein, eh, love? Well, good for you. Mustache, meeting Sammy at O'Connell's at 8. Archie had skin as thick as an alligator's. Being a father was such a solid genetic position in his mind, the solidest fact in Archie's life, it didn't occur to him that there might be any challenger to his crown. It was left to Clara to bite her lip alone, hope she wasn't losing her only daughter, and swallow the blood. But Alsana had finally concluded that it was all-out war and she needed an ally. Late January 91, Christmas and Ramadan safely out of the way, she picked up the phone.
So, you know about these Chalfinches?
Chalfins. I think the name is Chalfin. Yes, they're the parents of a friend of Irie's, I think, said Clara, disingenuously, wanting to know what Alsana knew first.
Joshua Chalfin, they sound a nice family.
Alsana blew air out of her nose.
I call them chaffinches, the little scavenging English birds pecking at all the best seeds. Those birds do the same to my bay leaves as these people do to my boy. But they are worse. They are like birds with teeth, with sharp little canines. They don't just steal, they rip apart. What do you know about them?
Well, nothing, really.
They've been helping Irie and Millat with their sciences, that's what she told me. I'm sure there's no harm, Alsie, and Irie's doing very well in school now. She is out of the house all the time, but I can't really put my foot down.
Clara heard Alsana slap the Iqbal banisters in fury.
Have you met them? Because I haven't met them, and yet they feel free to give my son money and shelter as if he had neither, and badmouth me, no doubt. God only knows what he is telling them about me. Who are they? I am not knowing them from Adam or Eve. Millat spends every spare minute with them, and I see no particular improvement in his grades, and he is still smoking the pot and sleeping with the girls. I try and tell Samad, but he's in his own world. He just won't listen. Just screams at Millat and won't speak to me. We're trying to raise the money to get Majid back and in the good school. I'm trying to keep this family together and these chaffinches are trying to tear it apart.
Clara bit her lip and nodded silently at the receiver.
Are you there, lady?
Yes,
said Clara.
Yes. You see, Irie, well, she seems to worship them. I got quite upset at first, but then I thought I was just being silly. Archie says I'm being silly. If you told that potato head there was no gravity on the moon, he'd think you were being silly. We get by without his opinion for 15 years. We'll manage without it now, Clara, said Alsana, and her heavy breath rattled against the receiver. Her voice sounded exhausted.
We always stand by each other. I need you now.
Yes. I'm just thinking. Please, don't think. I booked a movie, old and French, like you like. 2:30 today. Meet me in front of the Tricycle Theatre. Niece of Shame is coming too. We have tea, we talk.
The movie was A Bout de Souffle. 16mm, grey and white. Old Fords and boulevards, turn-ups and handkerchiefs, kisses and cigarettes. Clara loved it. Beautiful Belmondo, beautiful Seaburg, beautiful Paris. Nina found it too French, and Alsana couldn't understand what the bloody thing was about. Two young people running around France talking nonsense, killing policemen, stealing vehicles, never wearing bras. If that's European cinema, give me Bollywood every day of the week.
Now, ladies, shall we get down to business?
Nina went and collected the teas and plonked them on the little table.
So, what's this all about a conspiracy of chaffinches? Sounds like Hitchcock.
Alsana explained in shorthand the situation. Nina reached into a bag for her consulates, lit one up and exhaled minty smoke.
Auntie, they just sound like a perfectly nice middle-class family who are helping Mill out with his studies. Is that what you dragged me from work for? I mean, it's hardly Jonestown now, is it?
No, said Clara cautiously. No, of course not. But all your auntie is saying is that Millat and Iris spend such a lot of time over there, so we'd just like to know a bit more about what they're like. You know, that's natural enough, isn't it?
Alsana objected.
That is not all I am saying. I am saying these people are taking my son away from me. Birds with teeth. They're Englishifying him completely. They're deliberately leading him away from his culture and his family and his religion. Since when have you given two shits about his religion? You, niece of shame, you don't know how I sweat blood for that boy. You don't know about... Well, if I don't know anything about anything, why the bloody hell have you brought me here? I've got other fucking things to do, you know.
Nina snatched her bag and made to stand up.
Sorry about this, Clara. I don't know why this always has to happen. I'll see you soon. Sit down,
hissed Alsana, grabbing her by the arm.
Sit down. All right? Point made, Miss Clever Lesbian. Look, we need you. Okay? Sit down. Apology, apology. Okay? Better.
All right,
said Nina, viciously stubbing out her fag on a serviette.
But I'm going to speak my mind, and for once to shut that chasm of a mouth while I do it, okay? Okay. Right. Now, you just said Iris doing tremendous in school, and if Millat's not doing so well, it's no great mystery. He doesn't do any work. At least somebody's trying to help him. And if he's seeing too much of these people, I'm sure that's his choice, not theirs. It's not exactly happy land in your house at the moment, is it? He's running away from himself and he's looking for something as far away from the Iqbals as possible. Aha! But they live two roads away,
cried Alsana triumphantly.
No, Auntie. Conceptually far away from you. Being an Iqbal is occasionally a little suffocating, you know? He's using this other family as a refuge. They're probably a good influence or something.
Or something,
said Alsana, ominously.
What are you afraid of, Alsie? He's second generation. You always say it yourself. You need to let them go their own way. Yes, and look what happened to me, blah, blah, blah. I may be niece of shame to you, Alsie, but I earn a good living out of my shoes.
Alsana looked dubiously at the knee-length black boots that Nina had designed, made, and was wearing.
And I live a pretty good life, you know. I live by principles. I'm just saying. He's already having a war with Uncle Samad. He doesn't need one with you as well.
Alsana grumbled into her blackberry tea.
If you want to worry about something, Auntie, worry about these Kevin people he hangs around with. They're insane. And there's bloody loads of them. All the ones you wouldn't expect. Mo, you know, the butcher. Yes, you know, the Hussein Ishmaels, Ardashir's side of the family. Right, well, he's one, and bloody Shiva from the restaurant. He's converted.
Good for him, said Alsana tartly.
But it's nothing to do with Islam proper, Alsie. They're a political group, and some politics. One of the little bastards told me and Maxime we were going to roast in the pits of hell. Apparently we are the lowest forms of life, lower than the slugs. I gave his ball bag a 360-degree twist. Those are the people you need to worry about.
Alsana shook her head and waved Nina off with a hand.
Can't you understand? I worry about my son being taken away from me. I have lost one already. 6 years I have not seen Majid. 6 years. And I see these people, these chaffinches, and they spend more time with Millat than I do. Can you understand that, at least?
Nina sighed, fiddled with a button on her top, and then, seeing the tears forming in her auntie's eyes, conceded a silent nod.
Millat and Iri often go around there for dinner, said Clara, quietly. And Alsana, well, your auntie and I were wondering, if once you could go with them, you look young and you seem young, and you could go and report back,
finished Nina, rolling her eyes.
Infiltrate the enemy.
That poor family. They've no idea who they're messing with, have they? They're under surveillance and they don't even know it. It's like the bloody 39 steps. Niece of shame? Yes or no?
Nina groaned.
Yes, Auntie. Yes, if I must.
Much appreciated, said Alsana, finishing her tea. Now, it wasn't that Joyce was a homophobe. She liked gay men, and they liked her. She had even inadvertently amassed a little gay fan club in university, a group of men who saw her as a kind of Barbra Streisand, Betty Davis, Joan Baez hybrid, and met once a month to cook her dinner and admire her dress sense. So Joyce couldn't be homophobic. But gay women, something confused Joyce about gay women. It wasn't that she disliked them, she just couldn't comprehend them. Joyce understood why men would love men. She had devoted her life to loving men, so she knew how it felt. But the idea of women loving women was so far from Joyce's cognitive understanding of the world that she couldn't process it. The idea of them, she just didn't get it. God knows she'd made the effort. During the 70s, she dutifully read The Well of Loneliness and Our Bodies Ourselves, which had a small chapter. More recently, she had read and watched Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, but none of it did her any good. She wasn't offended by it. She just couldn't see the point. So when Nina turned up for dinner, arm in arm with Maxine, Joyce just sat staring at the two of them over the starter, pulses on rye bread, utterly fixated. She was rendered dumbstruck for the first 20 minutes, leaving the rest of the family to go through the Chalfen routine minus her own vital bit part. It was a little like being hypnotized or sitting in a dense cloud, and through the mist she heard snippets of dinner conversation continuing without her.
So, always the first Chalfen question, what do you do?
Shoes. I make shoes.
Not the material of sparkling conversation, I fear. What about the beautiful lady?
I'm a beautiful lady of leisure. I wear the shoes she makes.
Ah, not in college, then?
No, I didn't bother with college. Is that okay?
Nina was equally defensive.
And before you ask, neither did I.
Well, I didn't mean to embarrass you.
You didn't?
Because it's no real surprise. I know you're not the most academic family in the world.
Joyce knew things were going badly, but she couldn't find her tongue to smooth it out. A million dangerous double entendres were sitting at the back of her throat, and if she opened her mouth, even a slit, she feared one of them was going to come out. Marcus, who was always oblivious to causing offence, trundled on happily.
You two are terrible temptations for a man.
Are we?
Oh, dykes always are. And I'm sure certain gentlemen would have half a chance. You'd probably take beauty over intellect, I suspect, so there go my chances.
You seem awfully certain of your intellect, Mr. Chalfen.
Shouldn't I be? I am terribly clever, you know.
Joyce just kept looking at them, thinking, who relies on whom? Who teaches whom? Who improves whom? Who pollinates and who nurtures?
Well, it's great to have another Iqbal around the table, isn't it, Josh?
I'm a Begum, not an Iqbal, said Nina.
I can't help thinking, said Marcus, unheeding, that a Chalfen man and an Iqbal woman would be a hell of a mix, like Fred and Ginger. You'd give us sex and we'd give you sensibility or something. Hey? You'd keep a Chalfen on his toes. You're as fiery as an Iqbal. Indian passion. Funny thing about your family, first generation are all Looney Tunes, but the second generation have got heads just about straight on their shoulders.
Look. No one calls my family loony, okay? Even if they are, I'll call them loony.
Now, you see, try to use the language properly. You can say, no one calls my family loony, but that's not a correct statement, because people do and will. By all means say, I don't want people to, etc. It's a small thing, but we can all understand each other better when we don't abuse terms and phrases.
Then, just as Marcus was reaching into the oven to pull out the main course, chicken hot pot, Joyce's mouth opened, and for some inexplicable reason, this came out.
Do you use each other's breasts as pillows?
Nina's fork, which was heading for her mouth, stopped just as it reached the tip of her nose. Millat choked on a piece of cucumber. Irie struggled to bring her lower jaw back into alliance with the upper. Maxine began to giggle. But Joyce wasn't going to go purple. Joyce was descended from the kind of bloody-minded women who continued through the African swamps, even after the bag-carrying natives had dropped their load and turned back, even when the white men were leaning on their guns and shaking their heads. She was cut of the same cloth as the frontier ladies who, armed with only a Bible, a shotgun, and a net curtain, coolly took out the brown men moving forwards from the horizon towards the plains. Joyce didn't know the meaning of backing down. She was going to stand her ground. It's just, in a lot of Indian poetry, they talk about using breasts for pillows. Downy breasts, pillow breasts. I just wondered if white sleeps on brown, or, as one might expect, brown sleeps on white. Extending the pillow metaphor, you see, I was just wondering which way. The silence was long, broad, and malingering. Nina shook her head in disgust and dropped her cutlery onto her plate with a clatter. Maxine tapped her fingers on the tablecloth, making out a nervous William Tell. Josh looked like he might cry. Finally, Marcus threw his head back, clapped his hands, and let out an enormous Chalfin guffaw.
Oh, I've been wanting to ask that all night. Well done, Mother Chalfin.
And so, for the first time in her life, Nina had to admit that her auntie was absolutely right.
You wanted a report, so here's the full report. Crazy, nutso, raisin short of a fruitcake, rubber walls, screaming mad basket cases, every bloody one of them.
Alsana nodded, open-mouthed, and asked Nina to repeat for the third time the bit during dessert when Joyce, serving up a trifle, had inquired whether it was difficult for Muslim women to bake while wearing those long black sheets. Didn't the arm bits get covered in cake mixture? Wasn't there a danger of setting yourself alight on the gas hobs?
Bouncing off the walls, concluded Nina.
But, as is the way with these things, once confirmation had arrived, nobody knew quite what to do with the information. Irene Millat was 16 and never tired of telling their respective mothers that they were now of the legal age for various activities and could do whatever, whenever. Short of putting locks on the doors and bars on the windows, Clara and Alsana were powerless. If anything, things got worse. Irie spent more time than ever immersing herself in Chalvinism. Clara noticed her wincing at her own father's conversation and frowning at the middle-brow tabloid Clara curled up with in bed. Millat disappeared from home for weeks at a time, returning with money that was not his and an accent that modulated wildly between the rounded tones of the Chalfins and the street talk of the Kevin clan. He infuriated Samad beyond all reason. No, that's wrong. There was a reason. Millat was neither one thing nor the other, this or that, Muslim or Christian, Englishman or Bengali. He lived for the in-between. He lived up to his middle name. Zulfikar, the clashing of two swords.
How many times?
Samad growled after watching his son purchase the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Is it necessary to say thank you in a single transaction? Thank you when you hand the book over. Thank you when she receives it. Thank you when she tells you the price. Thank you when you sign the check. Thank you when she takes it. They call it English politeness when it is simply arrogance. The only being who deserves this kind of thanks is Allah himself.
And Alsana was once again caught between the two of them, trying desperately to find the middle ground.
If Majid was here, he'd sort you two out. A lawyer's mind. He'd make things straight.
But Majid wasn't here. He was there, and there was still not enough money to change the situation. Then the summer came, and with it, exams. Irie came in just behind Chalfin the Chubster, and Millat did far better than anyone, including he, had expected. It could only be the Chalfin influence, and Clara, for one, felt a little ashamed of herself. Alsana just said,
"Iqbal brains. In the end, they triumph,"
and decided to mark the occasion with a joint Iqbal Jones celebration barbecue to be held on Samad's lawn. Nina, Maxine, Ardashir, Shiva, Joshua, aunties, cousins, Irie's friends, Millat's friends, Kevin friends, and the headmaster all came and made merry, except for Kevin, who formed a circle in one corner, with paper cups filled with cheap Spanish bubbly.
It was going well enough until Samad spotted the ring of folded arms and green bow ties.
What are they doing here? Who let in the infidels?
Well, you're here, aren't you?
Sniped Alsana, looking at the three empty cans of Guinness Samad had already got through, the hot dog juice dribbling down his chin.
Who's casting the first stone at a barbecue?
Samad glared and lurched away with Archie to admire their shared handiwork on the reconstructed shed. Clara took the opportunity to pull Alsana aside and ask her a question. Alsana stamped a foot in her own coriander.
No! No way at all. What should I thank her for? If he did well, it was because of his own brains. Iqbal brains. Not once, not once! Has that long-toothed chapinch even condescended to telephone me? Wild horses will have to drag my dead body, lady. But I just think it would be a nice idea to go and thank her for all the time she spent with the children. I think maybe we misjudged her. By all means, go, Lady Jones. Go if you like, said Alsana scornfully. But as for me, wild horses could not do it.
And that's Dr. Solomon Chalfin, Marcus's grandfather. He was one of the few men who would listen to Freud when everybody in Vienna thought they had a sexual deviant on their hands.
An incredible face he has, don't you think? There's so much wisdom in it. The first time Marcus showed me that picture, I knew I wanted to marry him. I thought, if my Marcus looks like that at 80, I'll be a very lucky girl.
Clara smiled and admired the daguerreotype. She had so far admired 8 along the mantelpiece, with Irie trailing sullenly behind her, and there were at least as many left to go.
It's a grand old family, and if you don't find it too presumptuous, Clara,
it's Clara, all right. Clara's fine, Mrs. Chalfin.
Irie waited for Joyce to ask Clara to call her Joyce.
Well, as I was saying, it's a grand old family, and if you don't find it too presumptuous, I like to think of Irie as a kind of addition to it. In a way, she's just such a remarkable girl. We've so enjoyed having her around.
She's enjoyed being around, I think, and she really owes you a lot. We all do.
Oh, no, no, no. I believe in the responsibility of intellectuals. Besides which, it's been a joy.
Really?
I hope we'll still see her, even though the exams are over. There's still A-levels, if nothing else.
Oh, I'm sure she'd come anyway. She talks about you all the time. The Chalfin's this, the Chalfin's that.
Joyce clasped Clara's hands in her own.
Oh, Clara, I am pleased. And I'm pleased we finally met as well. Oh, now, I hadn't finished. Where were we? Oh, yes, well, here are Charles and Anna, great uncles and aunts long buried, sadly. He was a psychiatrist.
Yes,
another one. And she was a plant biologist, woman after my own heart.
Joyce stood back for a minute, like an art critic in a gallery, and put her hands on her hips.
I mean, after a while, you've got to suspect it's in the genes, haven't you? All these brains. I mean, nurture just won't explain it. I mean, will it?
No, agreed Clara.
I guess not.
Now, out of interest, I mean, I really am curious.
Which side do you think Irie gets it from? The Jamaican or the English?
Clara looked up and down the line of dead white men in starched collars, some monocled, some uniformed, some sitting in the bosom of their family, each member manacled into position so the camera could do its slow business. They all reminded her a little of someone. Of her own grandfather, the dashing Captain Charlie Durham, in his one extant photograph, pinched and pale, looking defiantly at the camera, not so much having his picture taken as forcing his image upon the acetate. What they used to call a muscular Christian. The Bowden family called him Whitey. Jam Foolboy taught he owned everything he touched.
My side, said Clara tentatively. I guess the English in my side. My grandfather was an Englishman, quite la-di-da, I've been told. His child, my mother, was born during the Kingston earthquake, 1907. I used to think maybe the rumble knocked the Bowden brain cells into place, because we've been doing pretty well since then.
Joyce saw that Clara was expecting a laugh, and quickly supplied one.
But seriously, it was probably Captain Charlie Durham. He taught my grandmother all she knew. A good English education. Lord knows, I can't think who else it could be.
Well, how fascinating!
It's what I say to Marcus. It is the genes, whatever he says. He says I'm a simplifier, but he's just too theoretical. I'm proven right all the time. As the front door closed behind her, Clara bit her own lip once more, this time in frustration and anger. Why had she said Captain Charlie Durham? That was a downright lie, false as her own white teeth. Clara was smarter than Captain Charlie Durham. Hortense was smarter than Captain Charlie Durham. Probably even Grandma Ambrosia was smarter than Captain Charlie Durham. Captain Charlie Durham wasn't smart. He had thought he was, but he wasn't. He sacrificed 1,000 people because he wanted to save one woman he never really knew. Captain Charlie Durham was a no-good, damn fool boy. 13. The Root Canals of Hortense Bowden. A little English education can be a dangerous thing. Alzana's favourite example of this was the old tale of Lord Ellenborough, who, upon taking the Sindh province from India, sent a telegram of only one word to Delhi, peccavi, a conjugated Latin verb meaning, I have sinned. The English are the only people, she would say with distaste, who want to teach you and steal from you at the same time. Alzana's mistrust for the Chalfins was no more or less than that. Clara agreed, but for reasons that were closer to home, a family memory, an unforgotten trace of bad blood in the Bowdens. Her own mother, when inside her mother, for if this story is to be told, we will have to put them all back inside each other like Russian dolls, Irie back in Clara, Clara back in Hortense, Hortense back in Ambrosia, was silent witness to what happens when all of a sudden an Englishman decides you need an education. For it had not been enough for Captain Charlie Durham, recently posted to Jamaica, to impregnate his landlady's adolescent daughter one drunken evening in the Bowden larder, May 1906. He was not satisfied with simply taking her maidenhood. He had to teach her something as well.
Me? You won't teach me?
Ambrosia Bowden had placed her hand over the tiny bump that was Hortense and tried to look as innocent as possible.
Why you won't teach me?
3 times a week, replied her mother. And don't ask me why, but Lord knows you could do with some improving. Be thankful for generosity. There is not required whys and wherefores when a handsome, upright English gentleman like Mr. Durham won't be generous.
Even Ambrosia Bowden, a capricious, long-legged, maga village child who had not seen a schoolroom in all of her 14 years, knew this advice was mistaken. When an Englishman wants to be generous, the first thing you ask is why, because there is always a reason.
You still here, Pickney? In one, see you. Don't let me spit pon the floor and make you get up there before it dry.
So Ambrosia Bowden, with Hortense inside her, had dashed up to the captain's room and returned there 3 times a week thereafter for instruction. Letters, numbers, the Bible, English history, trigonometry, and when that was finished, when Ambrosia's mother was safely out of the house, anatomy, which was a longer lesson, given on top of the student as she lay on her back, giggling. Captain Durham told her not to worry about the baby. He would do no damage to it. Captain Durham told her that their secret child would be the cleverest Negro boy in Jamaica. As the months flicked by, Ambrosia learned a lot of wonderful things from the handsome captain. He taught her how to read the trials of Job and study the warnings of Revelation, to swing a cricket bat, to recite Jerusalem, how to add up a column of numbers, how to decline a Latin noun, how to kiss a man's ear until he wept like a child. But mostly he taught her that she was no longer a maidservant, that her education had elevated her, that in her heart she was a lady, though her daily chores remained unchanged. In here, he liked to say, pointing to somewhere beneath her breastbone, the exact spot, in fact, where she routinely rested her broom. A maid no more, Ambrosia, a maid no more, he liked to say, enjoying the pun. And then one afternoon, when Hortense was 5 months unborn, Ambrosia sprinted up the stairs in a very loose, disingenuous gingham dress, rapped on the door with one hand, and hid a bunch of English marigolds behind her back with the other. She wanted to surprise her lover with flowers she knew would remind him of home. She banged and banged and called, but he was gone.
"Don't ask me why," said Ambrosia's mother,
eyeing her daughter's stomach with suspicion.
Him just get up and go. On this sudden. But him leave a message that he want you to be looked after still. He want you to go over to the estate quick time and present yourself to Mr. Glenard, a good Christian gentleman. Lord knows you could do with some improving. You still here, Pickney? Don't let me spit upon the floor and...
But Ambrosia was out of the door before the words hit the ground. It seemed Durham had gone to control the situation in a printing company in Kingston, where a young man called Garvey was staging a printer's strike for higher wages. And then he intended to be away for 3 further months to train His Majesty's Trinidadian soldiers, show them what's what. The English are experts at relinquishing one responsibility and taking up another, but they also like to think of themselves as men of good conscience. So in the interim, Durham entrusted the continued education of Ambrosia Bowden to his good friend, Sir Edmund Flecker Glenard, who was, like Durham, of the opinion that the natives required instruction, Christian faith, and moral guidance. Glenard was charmed to have her. Who wouldn't be? A pretty, obedient girl, willing and able round the house. But 2 weeks into her stay, and the pregnancy became obvious, people began to talk. It simply wouldn't do.
"Don't ask me why,"
said Ambrosia's mother, grabbing Glenard's letter of regret from her weeping daughter.
"Maybe you can be improved. Maybe him don't want sin around the house. You're back here now. There's nothing to be done now."
But in the letter, so it turned out, there was a consolatory suggestion.
"It say here him wanted to go and see a Christian lady called Mrs. Brenton. Him say he can't stay with her."
Now, Durham had left instructions that Ambrosia be introduced to the English Anglican Church, and Glenard had suggested the Jamaican Methodist Church, but Mrs. Brenton, a fiery Scottish spinster who specialised in lost souls, had her own ideas.
"We are going to the truth,"
she said decisively when Sunday came, because she did not care for the word church.
"You and I and the wee innocent,"
she said, tapping Ambrosia's belly just inches from Hortense's head,
"are going to hear the words of Jehovah."
For it was Mrs. Brenton who introduced the Bowdens to the Witnesses, the Russellites, the Watchtower, the Bible Tract Society. In those days, they went under many names. Mrs. Brenton had met Charles Taze Russell himself in Pittsburgh as the last century turned, and was struck by the knowledge of the man, his dedication, his mighty beard. It was his influence that made her a convert from Protestantism, and, like any convert, Mrs. Brenton took great pleasure in the conversion of others. She found 2 easy, willing subjects in Ambrosia and the child in her belly, for they had nothing to convert from. The truth entered the Bowdens that winter of 1906 and flowed through the bloodstream directly from Ambrosia to Hortense. It was Hortense's belief that at the moment her mother recognized Jehovah, Hortense herself became conscious, though still inside the womb. In later years, she would swear on any Bible you put in front of her that even in her mother's stomach, each word of Mr. Russell's Millennial Dawn, as it was read to Ambrosia night after night, passed as if by osmosis into Hortense's soul. Only this would explain why it felt like a remembrance to read the 6 volumes years later in adult life, why she could cover pages with her hand and quote them from memory, though she had never read them before. It is for this reason that any root canal of Hortense must go right to the very beginning, because she was there, she remembers, the events of the 14th of January 1907, the day of the terrible Jamaican earthquake, are not hidden from her, but bright and clear as a bell.
"Early will I seek thee, my soul thirsteth for thee. My flesh longeth for thee in a dry and thirsty land where no water is."
So sang Ambrosia as her pregnancy reached full term, and she bounced with her huge bulge down King Street, praying for the return of Christ or the return of Charlie Durham, the 2 men who could save her. So alike in her mind, she had the habit of mixing them up. She was halfway through the 3rd verse, or so Hortense told it, when that rambunctious old rumpot, Sir Edmund Flecker Glenard, flushed from 1 snifter too many at the Jamaica Club, stepped into their path.
"Captain Durham's maid,"
Hortense recalled him saying, by way of a greeting, and receiving nothing from Ambrosia but a glare.
"Fine day for it, eh?"
Ambrosia had tried to sidestep him, but he moved his bulk in front of her once more.
"So are you a good girl these days, my dear? Gossip informs me Mrs. Brenton has introduced you to her church. Very interesting, these witness people. But are they prepared, I wonder, for this new mulatto member of their flock?"
Hortense remembered well the feel of that fat hand landing hot against her mother. She remembered kicking out at it with all her might.
"Oh, it's all right, child. The captain told me your little secret. But naturally secrets have a price, Ambrosia, just as yams and pimento and my tobacco cost something. Now, have you seen the old Spanish church, Santa Antonia? Have you been inside? It's just here. It's quite a marvel inside, from the aesthetic rather than religious point of view. It will only take a moment, my dear. One should never pass up the opportunity of a little education, after all."
Every moment happens twice, inside and outside, and they are two different histories. Outside of Ambrosia, there was much white stone, no people, an altar peeling gold, little light, smoking candles, Spanish names engraved in the floor, and a large marble Madonna, her head bowed, standing high upon a plinth. All was preternaturally calm as Glennard began to touch her. But inside, there was a galloping heartbeat, the crush of a million muscles that wanted desperately to repel Glennard's attempts at an education, the clammy fingers that even now were at her breast, slipping between thin cotton and squeezing nipples already heavy with milk, milk never intended for such a rough mouth. Inside, she was already running down King Street, but outside, Ambrosia was frozen, rooted to the spot, as feminine a stone as any Madonna. And then the world began to shake. Inside Ambrosia, waters broke. Outside Ambrosia, the floor cracked. The far wall crumbled, the stained glass exploded, and the Madonna fell from a great height like a swooning angel. Ambrosia stumbled from the scene, making it only as far as the confessionals, before the ground split once more, a mighty crack. And she fell down, in sight of Glennard himself, who lay crushed underneath his angel, his teeth scattered on the floor, trousers round his ankles. And the ground continued to vibrate. A second crack came, and a third. The pillars fell, half the roof disappeared. Any other afternoon in Jamaica, the screams of Ambrosia, the screams that followed each contraction of her womb as Hortense pushed out, would have caught somebody's attention, brought somebody to her aid. But the world was ending that afternoon in Kingston. Everybody was screaming. If this were a fairy tale, it would now be time for Captain Durham to play hero. He does not seem to lack the necessary credentials. It is not that he isn't handsome, or tall, or strong, or that he doesn't want to help her, or that he doesn't love her. Oh, he loves her, just as the English loved India and Africa and Ireland. It is the love that is the problem. People treat their lovers badly. All those things are true. But maybe it is just the scenery that is wrong. Maybe nothing that happens upon stone ground can expect a happy ending. For when Durham returns, the day after the initial tremors, he finds an island destroyed, 2,000 already dead, fire in the hills, parts of Kingston fallen into the sea, starvation, terror, whole streets swallowed up by the earth, and none of this horrifies him as much as the realization that he might never see her again. Now he understands what love means. He stands in the parade ground, lonely and distraught, surrounded by 1,000 black faces he does not recognize. The only other white figure is the statue of Victoria, 5 aftershocks having turned her round by degrees until she appears to have her back to the people. This is not far from the truth. It is the Americans, not the British, who have the resources to pledge serious aid. 3 warships full of provisions presently snaking down the coast from Cuba. It is an American publicity coup that the British government does not relish, and like his fellow Englishmen, Durham cannot help but feel a certain wounded pride. He still thinks of the land as his to help or his to hurt, even now when it has proved itself to have a mind all of its own. He still retains enough of his English education to feel slighted when he spots 2 American soldiers who have docked without permission, all landings must go through Durham or his superiors, standing outside their consulate building, insolently chewing their tobacco. It is a strange feeling, this powerlessness, to discover there is another country more equipped to save this little island than the English. It is a strange feeling, looking out onto an ocean of ebony skins, unable to find the one he loves, the one he thinks he owns. Fadaram has orders to stand here and call out the names of the handful of servants, butlers and maids, the chosen few the English will be taking with them to Cuba until the fires die down. If he knew her last name, God knows he would call it out. But in all that teaching, he never learnt it. He never asked. Yet it was not for this oversight that Captain Durham, the great educator, was remembered as a fool boy in the annals of the Bowden clan. He found out soon enough where she was. He found little cousin Marlene amongst the throng, and sent her off with a note to the church hall where she had seen Ambrosia last, singing with the witnesses, offering thanks for the judgment day. While Marlene ran as fast as her ashen legs would carry her, Durham walked calmly, thinking the last act was done, to King's House, the residence of Sir James Swettenham, Governor of Jamaica. There he asked him to make an exception for Ambrosia, an educated negress he wished to marry. She was not like the others. She must have a place with him on the next outgoing ship. But if you are to rule a land that is not yours, you get used to ignoring exceptions. Swettenham told him frankly there were no spaces on his boats for black whores or livestock. Durham, hurt and vengeful, inferred that Swettenham had no power of his own, that the arrival of American ships was proof of that, and then, as a parting shot, mentioned the two American soldiers he had seen on British soil without permission, presumptuous upstarts on land they didn't own. "Does the baby go out with the bathwater?" demanded Durham, face red as a pillar-box, resorting back to the religion of possession that was his birthright. "Is this not still our country? Is our authority so easily toppled by a few rumbles in the ground? The rest is that terrible thing. History." As Swettenham ordered the American boats to return to Cuba, Marlene came running back with Ambrosia's reply. One sentence torn from Job. "I will fetch my knowledge from afar." Hortense kept the Bible it was ripped from, and liked to say that from that day forth no Bowden woman took lessons from anyone but the Lord. Marlene handed the sentence to Durham and ran off into the parade ground, happy as a clam, in search of her mother and father who were injured and weak, on their last legs, and waiting for the boats like thousands of others. She wanted to tell them the good news, what Ambrosia had told her. "It soon come, it soon come." "The boats?" Marlene had asked, and Ambrosia had nodded, though she was too busy with prayer, too ecstatic to hear the question. "It soon come, it soon come," she said, repeating what she had learnt from Revelation. What Durham and then Glenard and then Mrs. Brenton had taught her in their different ways, what the fire and earth cracks and thunder attested to. "It soon come," she told Marlene, who took her word for gospel. A little English education can be a dangerous thing. 14. More English than the English. In the great tradition of English education, Marcus and Madget became pen pals. How they became pen pals was a matter of fierce debate. Alsana blamed Millat. Millat claimed Irie had slipped Marcus the address. Irie said Joyce had sneaked a peek in her address book. The Joyce explanation was correct. But either way they were, and from March 91 onwards, letters passed between them with a frequency let down only by the chronic inadequacies of the Bengal postal system. Their combined output was incredible. Within 2 months, they had filled a volume at least as thick as Keats's, and by four were fast approaching the length and quantity of the true epistophiles, St. Paul, Clarissa, disgusted from Tunbridge Wells. Because Marcus made copies of all his own letters, Irie had to rearrange her filing system to provide a drawer solely devoted to their correspondence. She split the filing system in two, choosing to file by author primarily, then chronologically, rather than let simple dates rule the roost. Because this was all about people. People making a connection across continents, across seas. She made two stickers to separate the wads of material. The first said, "From Marcus to Madget." The second said, "From Madget to Marcus." An unpleasant mixture of jealousy and animosity led Irie to abuse her secretarial role. She pinched small collections of letters that wouldn't be missed, took them home, slipped them from their sheaths, and then, after close readings that would have shamed F.R. Leavis, carefully returned them to their file. What she found in those brightly stamped airmail envelopes brought her no joy. Her mentor had a new protege, Marcus and Majid. Majid and Marcus, it even sounded better. The way Watson and Crick sounded better than Watson, Crick, and Wilkins. John Donne said, "More than kisses, letters mingle souls." And so they do. Irie was alarmed to find such a commingling as this, such a successful merging of two people from ink and paper, despite the distance between them. No love letters could have been more ardent, no passion more fully returned, right from the very start. The first few letters were filled with the boundless joy of mutual recognition, tedious for the sneaky mailroom boys of Dhaka, bewildering to Irie, fascinating to the writers themselves. "It is as if I had always known you. If I were a Hindu, I would suspect we met in some former life. Majid." "You think like me. You're precise. I like that." Marcus. "You put it so well and speak my thoughts better than I ever could. In my desire to study the law, in my longing to improve the lot of my poor country, which is victim to every passing whim of God, every hurricane and flood, in these aims, what instinct is fundamental? What is the root, the dream which ties these ambitions together? To make sense of the world, to eliminate the random." Majid. And then there was the mutual admiration that lasted a good few months. "What you are working on, Marcus, these remarkable mice, it is nothing less than revolutionary. When you delve into the mysteries of inherited characteristics, surely you go straight to the soul of the human condition as dramatically and fundamentally as any poet, except you are armed with something essential the poet does not have, the truth. I am in awe of visionary ideas and visionaries. I am in awe of such a man as Marcus Chalfin. I call it an honour to be able to call him friend. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking such an inexplicable and glorious interest in my family's welfare. Majid." It is incredible to me, the bloody fuss people make about an idea like cloning. Cloning, when it happens, and I can tell you it will be sooner rather than later, is simply delayed twinning, and never in my life have I come across a couple of twins who prove more decidedly the argument against genetic determinism than Millat and yourself. In every area in which he lacks, you excel. I wish I could turn that sentence around for a vice versa effect, but the hard truth is he excels in nothing apart from charming the elastic waistband of my wife's knickers. Marcus. And finally, there were the plans for the future, plans made blindly and with amorous speed, like the English nerd who married a 19-stone Mormon from Minnesota because she sounded sexy on the chat line. "You must get to England as soon as possible. Early 93 at the very latest. I'll stump up some of the cash myself if I have to. Then we can enroll you in the local school, get the exams over and done with, and send you off post-haste to whichever of the dreaming spires tickles your fancy, though obviously there's only one real choice. And while you're at it, you can hurry up and get older, get to the bar, and provide me with the kind of lawyer I need to fight in my corner. My future mouse, copyright, needs a staunch defender. Hurry up, old chap. I haven't got all millennium." Marcus. The last letter, not the last letter they wrote, but the last one Irie could stomach, included this final paragraph from Marcus. "Well, things are the same round here, except that my files are in excellent order, thanks to Irie. You'll like her. She's a bright girl, and she has the most tremendous breasts. Sadly, I don't hold out much hope for her aspirations in the field of hard science, more specifically in my own biotechnology, which she appears to have her heart set on. She's sharp, in a way, but it's the menial work, the hard grafting, that she's good at. She'd make a lab assistant, maybe, but she hasn't any head for the concepts, no head at all. She could try medicine, I suppose, but even there you need a little bit more chutzpah than she's got, so it might have to be dentistry for our Irie. She could fix her own teeth, at least. An honest profession, no doubt, but one I hope you'll be avoiding." In the end, Irie wasn't offended. She had the sniffles for a while, but they soon passed. She was like her mother, like her father, a great reinventor of herself, a great make-doer. Can't be a war correspondent? Be a cyclist. Can't be a cyclist? Fold paper. Can't sit next to Jesus with the 144,000.
Join the great crowd. Can't stand the great crowd? Marry Archie. Irie wasn't so upset. She just thought, right. Dentistry. I'll be a dentist. Dentistry. Right. And meanwhile, Joyce was below deck trying to sort out Millat's problems with white women, which were numerous. All women